This is ensemble member K. Todd Freeman, and you're listening to the Steppenwolf Theatre Company podcast.
Hello, this is Aaron Carter, literary manager here at Steppenwolf. This season, we're trying something new with our podcasts. In addition to in-studio conversations with ensemble members and guest artists, we're also bringing you recordings of the public events we produce in support of our subscription season. You know, in addition to the plays themselves, we create a variety of events that offer you the chance to come to the theater and engage in dialogue with the themes and ideas that drive our programming. These events have been so successful, we thought we'd capture the spirit of them and make them available to a wider audience via this podcast. Today, we're bringing you a conversation between artistic director Martha Levy and Bill Savage, senior lecturer at Northwestern University and expert on Chicago history. Martha and Bill sat down to talk about the changing face of Chicago neighborhoods and how that history relates to our production of Clybourne Park by Bruce Norris. As a Chicago theater, Steppenwolf is thrilled to share this conversation with you. There's been an amazing energy generated as we've brought this play that has deep Chicago roots to a Chicago audience. You know, I first moved to the city almost 15 years ago and have lived in a number of different neighborhoods. One of the things I find so compelling about Bill's conversation with Martha is how deftly he exposes the forces that drive the evolution of neighborhoods. Living here, it can feel like some unseen hand is reshaping the city, but Bill shines a light on the process and asks us to consider our personal relationship to it.
Bill and I know each other because we were in graduate school same time at Northwestern.
Right. Long time
in
ago.
Literature critical theory classes
right.
or something.
One with Jerry Graff and with Saul Morrison, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And now Bill is a senior lecturer at Northwestern University. And Bill, the stuff that you mm-hmm. wrote about mm-hmm. in getting your doctorate, mm-hmm. right? Was American literature and specifically Chicago literature.
Right, Nelson Algren in particular.
And you are also, it happens, a lifelong Chicago resident, correct?
Yeah, it's an ironic convergence of things. I've lived in Rogers Park my whole life, so writing and talking and teaching about neighborhood novelists, I also have the sort of experience of being a neighborhood guy.
You know, the cool thing about that is that Bruce's play, Clybourne Park,
right.
it is a two-act play. The first act is set in 1959 in a Chicago neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. A mythical Chicago neighborhood.
Yes, a mythical Chicago neighborhood. And the second act is in that same neighborhood, same house,
right.
in 2009. So 50 years later.
Right.
And I think that, you know, perhaps you and I can spend some right. time talking about Chicago in this last 50 years.
Right. Well, one of the things that happens if you're in the same place for as long as I have been or some people end up being is you get what I call vertical knowledge. That is layers of knowledge over time about how the place has changed. So these are the sort of people who refer to stores by the three owners ago last name.
Yes.
Or homes by who lived there when they were in grammar school. They remember streets and places as much by what used to be there as by what's there now. And that is a really important part of understanding cities over time, because cities are always a combination of persistence and change. Certain aspects stay pretty much the same, the grid of streets, for instance. But even that changes when
yes.
they built the expressway system. You know, whole streets were obliterated, whole neighborhoods were wiped out. So there's always this tension, and that's one of the things I think this play really captures, is the tension between what that house means to the different people who live in it, who want to live in it, who want to tear it down and build something new.
This sort of starting point of the play is that this is the white family that sells to the first black family in
right.
that neighborhood. And it's in the context of Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in
right,
the Sun.
Right.
And of course, Hansberry, also a Chicagoan at that point.
Right.
And so the parallel.
Well, the overlap is really interesting. I don't know that parallel is exactly the word I would use. It's because the people experiencing it wouldn't be experiencing it in the same way.
Right. right?
It's maybe from the other perspective or a different camera angle. But the sort of drama in the play, not to give away any plot points, but like the personal tragedy that makes this white family want to get out of that house, out of that neighborhood, out to Glen Meadows, again, a perfect name that isn't a real place
right.
In Chicago's suburban geography. Is really important because it isn't just like wanting to make as much money as they can on their house. They feel like they've lost their sense of community.
Yes.
Because of the way the people around them treated them after their son and his actions in the war were known and after you know, the tragedy in the attic, let's call it that.
Yes.
So the sense that what you owe your neighbors is a mutual thing.
Yes.
And maybe if the neighbors had treated this family different, this couple and their son, maybe they wouldn't want to leave the neighborhood. Maybe they would accept, hey, we're here and it's changing and we'll live with it, instead of wanting to get the heck out of there. And what's ironic for me about that moment in American history is the way that what I think of as a combination of ignorance and evil, that is racism, produces its own self-fulfilling prophecies, right? The neighborhood will go to hell if they move in. So the minute any of them move in, everyone gets out and the neighborhood does indeed utterly transform. The decline is not because of the people who've moved in, it's because of the banking structures and the real estate practices. And then essentially, once a neighborhood changed racial status back in these days, city services would dry up and go away. And indeed, the neighborhood would fall apart because it wasn't being cared for by institutions properly. And so this idea of the 50s as sort of leave it to beaver
yes.
paradise that a lot of people promote is just utterly wrong. I mean, it's historically inaccurate, and it's an attempt to create a golden age that never was, to compare our fallen age to now. And this is one reason why I really think Bruce's play is so great, because he's got little nuances that add layers, like calling it Clybourne Park. There is no 406 North Clybourne. Clybourne starts at Division. But Clybourne with an E, that was the name of one of the first white settlers in Chicago.
Oh, gosh.
Archibald Clybourne. Well, I came here in 1802. So as far as the Potawatomi were concerned, he was the first gentrifier.
Oh,
or one
gosh.
Of the first.
Yes.
Right? So there's these layers, and then, you know, Park is the eponym of so many different Chicago neighborhoods on every side of town. The proximity to the Loop is very important. That's where gentrification tends to happen first, because people want to have a quick commute. But that's also where slums developed first, because those are the oldest parts of town. So they're the ones that physically deteriorated fastest. So he's got all sorts of little nuances and details that are really, really interesting in terms of making this a Chicago play, as well as the sort of more broad address to American identity that he's also doing.
Yes, you know, and it's interesting. The first act of the play, as you're describing it, Bill, mm-hmm. it talks about when neighborhoods that were majority white mm-hmm. or exclusively white mm-hmm. change,
right.
When the ethnicity of the mm-hmm. neighborhood changes. The second act of the play, talk about right. that in the
well,
context
it,
of.
It seems to me that the first act helps us understand what whiteness means.
Yeah.
And I know Bruce has said that this is a play about whiteness. Up until the late 19th and into the early 20th century, what we think of as ethnic white groups would have been considered almost as separate as the races.
Yes.
And you had as much conflict between Irish and German and Irish and Polish and Italian and Lithuanian and all these groups that now we tend to think of as primarily a white versus black thing. One of the ways that sense of white identity got created in the urban landscape was racial covenants that would exclude African Americans from renting or buying in particular neighborhoods. These covenants were created in usually two ways. One would be, and I use the term very loosely, gentlemen's agreements among real estate brokers, essentially. The other would be community groups would get together and get all the property owners in an area to sign off on these covenants, agreeing not to sell to whatever group you defined as the other. And sometimes it would be Jews or Catholics as well.
And don't you love yeah. it, Phil, in the second act, when precisely yeah. the situation you're describing, okay,
right.
so the African-American couple who's selling the house and the white couple right. who's moving in from the suburbs
right.
to be part of the, you know, the urban return.
The neighborhood they love. I love your neighborhood.
Yeah. yeah. But it's so fantastic. And, you know, the assumption for a great course of that act on the part of the woman is, oh, you're that racism is somehow at the bottom of this.
Right.
And finally the African-American woman says, no, I object to it because your taste,
yeah.
what I object to.
Yeah, you're going to build this horrible, ugly McMansion on my block
yeah.
in the building that my great aunt bought. I mean, it's very much about the transformative effects of gentrification being aesthetic as well as racial and class. For a neighbor to be gentrifiable, it has to have a certain kind of housing stock, a certain kind of relationship to the transportation systems, usually the CTA, but also, you know, arterial roads and so forth. And it has to have once been a good neighborhood that declined and became a bad neighborhood, or an industrial working district where the factories and warehouses shut down, that then becomes attractive to first artists who are poor and need a place to live, then the people who open coffee shops for artists, then the people who open bookstores and bars for artists, then the people who want to live around bookstores, bars, and coffee shops in a neighborhood full of artists. And maybe the most vivid example of this in Chicago in the last decade or few decades has been Wicker Park.
Yes.
Bucktown, which when Nelson Algren lived there was a Polish ghetto that was transforming into a Latino ghetto. Now it is a hipster capital of the planet.
One of the things also that I think is really deft on Bruce's part in the play is to introduce this idea of territory. There's this curious banter that keeps happening in the play where people are trying to remember the capital of
Morocco.
Yeah, right. Or Ulaanbaatar, that's the capital of Mongolia. Yeah. You know, and and he has commented that he introduces the idea of territory and, knowledge of the world also, I mean, as a measure of sophistication.
Right. And he connects both of those things to the political situation of the moment. Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, the Cold War, the Soviet Union and China, Morocco, the war against terror, Islam in America.
Yes.
So there's this echoing of empire, essentially. But identity in Chicago is always geography. You are where you're from. And identity is almost always also structured on difference. We are not like you.
Right.
They are not like us. And in that second act, it's just seething right below the surface. I mean, I kept waiting for fisticuffs to break out. It seemed like they were just all on the verge of going at it. It's also gendered, too.
Yes.
It's always the women who don't know what the capital of the other country is or don't know why it's interesting to say Ulaanbaatar.
Uh-huh.
And that's a really fascinating thing, too, about the sort of gendering of this process, right? The men want to come in and knock the house down and build something new. The woman wants it to be big enough for the kid. Does the guy really want to have a kid? I mean, it's really complicated. And on the other side of the racial barrier, it seems much simpler. Like, the African-American relationships in the play seem more direct.
Let me ask you something else, and this is to do with Bruce's. Bruce has a fascination and obviously a great joy in language.
Oh, it's a beautiful play.
Yeah. And one of the things that he does is humor, and the tests the level of danger and what the limits are in this kind of joke telling.
Yeah.
Talk about what that...
Well, joke telling is also the thing that's very much about in-group, out-group dynamics, right? When I talk in my classes about what I call fossil prejudice, you know, ancient ethnic prejudice that we forget about but that's still preserved in the language, like the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame as a football team name, right? The image of the Irish as brawlers. And I always tell a joke that I have to frame a very particular way. And what I say is, regarding Notre Dame, Woody Allen says that calling a football team the Fighting Irish is like calling a football team the Haggling Jews. Now, Woody Allen is Jewish and can tell that joke. I'm Irish and I can't.
Right.
So I have to quote Woody Allen telling that joke.
Right.
And you see that same thing in the second act where it's not, I heard this joke from a black guy, so it must be okay, but it's not funny, but it plays on stereotypes. All ethnic humor plays on stereotypes. And all ethnic humor is about mocking an outsider. But who that outsider is can shift depending on the context in the moment. And the idea that the joke is offensive just because it's not funny is really the key. Like, what is the humor
here? And that's the taste thing, too. It's like, you know...
Why would you think this is a funny joke? Well, you're the sort of person who would build a McMansion on my street of little bungalows.
The instigating incident in encouraging this family to move is that this sense of loss of community.
Right.
And it has to do with their son who served in the Korean War. Start taking the Korean War. I mean, obviously, it's the time in which the Lorraine Hansberry play is set. But it's very significant. I mean, it's described as a proxy war. It's described as the forgotten war.
Right, and it wasn't even a war. It was a police action.
Yes.
I mean, it was the first war that was, you know, the United Nations working in concert. It was, you know, the North Koreans and South Koreans were proxies for the Soviets and the Chinese and the U.S. and the Europeans. And, you know, men came back from that war, and it was like people were so tired of it after World War II, and it's only 5 years later, and now it happens again. But it was also, in some ways, one of the first modern media wars. It got covered in a way that was a little beyond World War II's coverage. It was less censorship. So the fact that he would come home from a war where, like the Vietnam War, the vets weren't particularly honored or held up, although many of them were also World War II vets. They're 5 years out of the army, they get drafted again and get sent back. And he wasn't one of those, he was younger. So it's a sense of the tragedy that shaped this guy's life and then that made his parents want to move to Glen Meadows was part of the larger geopolitical situation. Like, we don't live in our neighborhood, we live in the world.
Yes.
And the world is going to come down in the neighborhood and really sort of put its thumb down if you aren't really able to create a sense of community that can not necessarily fight back against the world, but sustain you through it. One of the things that really struck me, though, connecting the two acts, is that in the second act, we find out that the neighborhood, the neighbor's son who was developmentally disabled, who was working at the grocery store, continued working at that grocery store into the point where the neighborhood was entirely African American.
Yes.
So there's a sense of, like, the only white guy who stays in the neighborhood is the guy who's mentally, insufficient.
Yeah.
Everyone else got the heck out. And this guy just would bag groceries at whatever new grocery store gets built. That's what I mean about Norris being so sneaky. There's these little details that if you stop and think, like the Clyburn thing, I'm like, I got to look up Clyburn and figure out what's going on with that. Because he's making up a neighborhood, but he picks a street that's right here Yet, who's that street named after? And sure enough, it's one of the first gentrifiers.
One of the things, Bill, that I want to talk about is the manifestation of racism in the American South versus the North.
Right, right.
I mean, one of the things, maybe a way to, tell me if this is too broad, that in the South, racism was enforced by actual law, and in the North, it worked differently. You've talked about covenants.
Right. Well, in the South, you had the Jim Crow laws, which were, you know, started being put in place right after Reconstruction was abandoned. I hate to say Reconstruction failed, because it didn't get a chance to succeed. And it was, people forget sometimes, for instance, with like the lunch counter protest during the early parts of the Civil Rights Movement, it was illegal for white people to serve black people. It wasn't just that black people couldn't be served, it's that the white people were breaking the law too. So African Americans begin coming north not long after the Civil War, in part to escape that particular form of legalized racism, which of course was also backed up with lynch law. Racism in the North, especially the industrial North, was tempered by the need for workers. So when African Americans came to the city, they were often used as strike breakers against white ethnics, which didn't help with race relations. They were also, though, because of the de facto, although not de jure, racial segregation, where real estate companies would not rent or sell to African Americans outside a certain prescribed area, the Black Belt on the south side, either side of State Street, and it kept expanding east and west and south because hundreds of thousands of people kept coming from the south, especially in the 30s and 40s after they managed to mechanize cotton picking. James T. Farrell is a great writer to read about this. Obviously, Richard Wright is the first guy you want to go to, along with Gwendolyn Brooks and Hansberry and Langston Hughes and other African-American writers. But writing from the perspective of white neighborhood people feeling threatened by blacks moving in, and white neighborhood people not feeling threatened. I mean, he has sort of the both sides of the equation. He has white characters who are fine with African-Americans and white characters who attack them physically to keep them out of the neighborhood. But he describes the process by which this kind of racial division gets created. And one of his best lines is in a short story called The Fastest Runner on 61st Street. And it's a moment where this character who's kind of a little slow is, you know, leading people to fight in the 1919 race riots to defend Washington Park from the blacks.
And Washington Park is
on the south side, west of Hyde Park, east of Garfield Park. It's part of the big park and boulevard system that was built in the 1850s and expanded in the 19th century. And it was the boundary between the African-American neighborhood and a white neighborhood. And this character, the narrator says, you know, he'd always heard Washington Park was a white man's park. He had heard it so often he believed it. So the public space of the park is transformed into a private space.
You know, if people were interested in getting an impression of some of Chicago's, the story of its neighborhoods, what are some of the things that you would recommend having people read?
I would begin with James Farrell. I mean, his short stories in a collection called Chicago Stories are very much about this process. He talks about a lot of stuff going on in the teens and 20s. Then Richard Wright with Native Son, which is just a monumental book, and a book that really dramatizes the essential self-fulfilling prophecy of white racism, which is if you treat people like they're animals, eventually they will turn into animals and bite you. Then Nelson Algren would be the next sort of part of that timeline, 40s and 50s in Wicker Park. And each has a separate neighborhood. You know, Farrell is the white Irish South Side, Wright is the African-American, the Black Belt if you didn't like it, Brownsville if you did, and Algren is what we now call Wicker Park or Bucktown, but then was called the Near Northwest Side. And with Algren, I would go with the short stories in the Neon Wilderness or the novel The Man with the Golden Arm. Those are the books that kind of tell the story of that neighborhood. And it's always a story of flux and change.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoy the new format. In addition to these recordings of events, we'll still be bringing you interviews with ensemble artists and visiting artists to the theater. For more information about events at Steppenwolf, visit us at steppenwolf.org.